British Public Radio. Nature.
Coming up this week, the biggest risks you've never heard of.
Everyone talks about viruses and pandemic flu, and people get scared about that sort of thing. But actually, fungi are responsible for about 70% of known local species extinctions over history.
And how we can help forecast weather in the developing world.
What you can do are form relationships between the global centres, forecasting centres, and the Myanmars and the Mongolias, where you have groups of people who are used to developing modules for flood forecasting.
Plus controversy over the molecules that make memories. I'm Kerry Smith.
And I'm Charlotte Stoddart. We survived the Mayan apocalypse in December, but according to a feature in Nature this week, we mustn't get complacent. An earth-shattering event could hit at any time. It might be the explosion of a supervolcano or a massive asteroid impact like the one that killed off the dinosaurs. Freelance reporter Nicola Jones has been cataloguing these rare but catastrophic events and asking when one might happen next. I took a break from building my nuclear bunker to get the lowdown from Nicola.
Well, we were looking at things that would have a major, major impact on humanity, either by causing a full-on extinction or just causing mass havoc and mayhem. And also we were looking for things that people might not have heard so much of before. So there are some things like a flu pandemic that we didn't cover in this piece, but that's because it's received so much attention elsewhere.
You came up then with four categories. We've got death by earth, death by fungus, death by fire, and death by water, all pretty terrifying. Which one of those worries you most?
Probably the fungus, because it could happen, well, any of them could technically happen tomorrow, but the fungus one seems to me to have the highest probability of having a big impact in the near future. So everyone talks about viruses and pandemic flu, and people get scared about that sort of thing, but actually fungi are responsible for about 70% of known local species extinctions over history. So if you're not worried about just an illness that's going to kill lots of people, but you're worried about species extinctions, then fungi are the things to worry about. And so right now they're currently threatening all sorts of things like bats, bees, amphibians, and lots of staple crops, including potatoes, wheat, corn, soy, and rice. And that's the bit that's worrying for us.
Right, okay. And so if we survive death by fungus, there are then various ways to die by fire. And these are extraterrestrial threats. Tell us about those.
So these are cosmic hazards. So there are all sorts of different things that could whack into the planet from outer space, including solar flares, asteroids, stray comets, or gamma rays. And gamma rays are kind of the most interesting one that you might not have heard of before. So there's lots of different sources of gamma rays, and these are basically stars that are colliding into each other or falling into black holes, and as a result, letting loose beams of energy. And if one of those beams of energy happens to be directed towards our planet, then it can have devastating effects. It would basically strip away a lot of our ozone layer, which would allow a lot of ultraviolet radiation to hit the planet, which would up cancer rates, and more importantly, would wipe out a lot of the smaller plant life, like phytoplankton in the ocean, and do a lot of damage to crops. So again, we would go hungry.
Okay, and if we survive these extraterrestrial threats, then we've got the threats that come from the Earth itself, like these supervolcanoes. Where are these supervolcanoes?
Well, so the most famous one that people know about is Yellowstone National Park, and it's obvious that that's a volcanic site because there's so much steam coming out of the ground and sulfuric smells and lots of bubbling. But that area is capable of causing mass havoc, so if Yellowstone National Park really were to blow its top in a supervolcanic eruption, it would cover all of North America with centimeters of ash and create basically a nuclear winter, which would again kill all the crops and cause people to go hungry.
Okay, and finally we've got death by water. Explain that one.
Sure, so this is tsunamis. And in recent years, of course, we've seen several devastating tsunamis, and those were caused by earthquakes. But there are other ways of causing tsunamis that could be even larger, and that's from underwater landslides.
And how big are the tsunamis that we're talking about? Are they a lot bigger than the one we saw in Japan in 2011, for example?
Well, sometimes they're about the same size, but they can be much bigger. They have the capacity to be hundreds of times bigger. So, for example, thousands of years ago in Hawaii, part of the volcanic island fell into the ocean, and that caused a wave that was as high as the Eiffel Tower, so hundreds of meters high.
So, Nicola, what's the take-home message from all of this? Should we really be worried, or are these things pretty unlikely to happen?
You know, should you be worried is kind of a philosophical question. It depends on your outlook. These things really can happen any day, and a lot of them we wouldn't see coming in advance. So it depends if you're the kind of person who chooses to worry about that sort of thing or not.
So it's pretty hard to predict when these events might happen. But if they do happen, is there anything we can do to prevent them or mitigate their effects?
Well, so for the fungi infections, there are, of course, and people are currently working on ways of making crops that are resistant to fungal infections. So that's an important thing to be doing. Solar flares, there's something we can do about. We can protect our power grids against solar flares so that they don't go completely down in the event of a flare. And also we can practice turning off the power grids before the big flares come and watching for them. And asteroids, too, there's a lot of effort to try and see what asteroids are out there and try and predict whether they're going to whack into the Earth. If they are, there are theoretical ways of dealing with that, like sending up a spaceship to act as a kind of gravity tractor to pull the asteroid out of its current trajectory so it doesn't hit the Earth. So for some of them, there are things that can be done, and people are doing most of those things.
That was reporter Nicola Jones. Still to come, how bisexuality boosts sex appeal in fish and using brain power alone to move prosthetic limbs more precisely than ever before. That's in the research highlights. But first, the mystery over the molecules that make memories. Over to you, Kerry.
It's 2013. So what did you do on New Year's Eve? Whatever your evening was like, and unless you overdid the champagne, you'll have a firm memory of it. Your grandma's attempt at charades, the taste of the bubbly, or the sound of the fireworks. Neuroscientists, of course, want to know more about how those memories get there and stay there. Here's Richard Hugenier from Johns Hopkins University in Maryland.
Understanding how memory works is really, first of all, it's a great mystery. It's one of the great mysteries of neuroscience, and memory is who we are. So just intellectually, it's exciting to try to understand that. But also, this has ramifications for many memory-related disorders. So if we really understand how memory is encoded in the brain, we might be able to enhance it in the case of memory disorders such as Alzheimer's disease. Or even in certain cases, we might want to erase memory in the case of PTSD or other traumatic events.
The fact you can recall New Year's Eve 2 weeks later is thanks to a host of proteins in your brain that busily strengthen connections between brain cells and then keep those connections strong to maintain the memory. This process is called long-term potentiation, or LTP. Memory researcher Roger Nickel of the University of California, San Francisco.
The general ideas have been around for a long time, and that is that the connections between nerve cells strengthen when you're learning, all right, and so that the connections become stronger and then remain strong, and that's sort of the way we store information.
For years, one particular protein has been cast as the star of the show. It's called PKM-zeta. It's persistently active in the brain over days or even weeks, active long enough, maybe, to maintain memories. Todd Sachter's lab at Downstate Medical Center in New York has been interested in it for years.
We came to realize that if you inhibited PKM-zeta, you would do something that had never been shown in 70 years of research on memory and, you know, trying to understand it by using drugs, which was if you inhibited PKM-zeta, you should be able to erase memory. That's exactly what we showed a couple of years ago.
Subsequent experiments confirmed the importance of PKM-zeta as the memory molecule. But this week in Nature, two studies challenge its dominance. Richard Hugenier's team did one of them.
What we wanted to do was really try to understand exactly what the mechanism is, how PKM-zeta modifies synapses. So we started to take a more molecular approach to actually genetically delete the enzyme PKM-zeta in mice. and to test the question if mice that do not have PKM zeta, to see if they have long-term memory and whether they have long-term potentiation that is maintained for several hours. But much to our surprise, the mice actually learned very well. They had long-term memories, and they also had LTP, which was maintained for several hours. So this is was quite a surprise. So these mice without the enzyme were behaving just like normal wild-type mice.
Another paper by a separate group at the University of California in San Francisco finds much the same thing. Mice with PKM zeta missing still remember stuff. Curious. So what is doing the job, if not the hallowed PKM zeta? For Todd Sachter, it makes sense that for such a complex process as making a memory, there's a backup, in this case, another version of the same protein.
So I think what's happening here is that when you knock out the zeta gene, the lambda gene has to take over its function. And in fact, that's been shown in other cells that these two genes compensate for each other. So it's not too surprising that they would compensate for something as important as memory. I think that's where the future is going to be, is to look more closely in this knockout to see whether the lambda is taking over the function.
But the hoo-ha over PKM zeta isn't the only challenge the field is facing. In a paper in Nature just a few weeks ago, Roger Nickel found another essential part of the process to be, well, not essential. Hugenier's work is on how connections are kept strong for weeks and months. Nickel looks at how the connections first get reinforced. To strengthen a connection, the receiving nerve cell amasses a bunch of receptors ready to take in chemical signals, a bit like putting on more trains at rush hour.
These receptors have these long tails that dangle inside of the cell, and a great deal of work had been done trying to identify various aspects of these tails. So what we did was we took off the C-tails, so we have a very clean system. The surprise was that, lo and behold, the phenomenon was absolutely intact. So this is sort of forcing a reanalysis and the generation of new ways in which to approach this phenomenon, because it really upsets a rather substantial body of knowledge.
With all these challenges, is the field having a funny 5 minutes or a serious crisis? Todd Sachter is optimistic.
Well, I think that's the way science works, is that you make progress and then things get challenged and then people answer and they respond and then we understand more. That's exactly the way science works. There's more to come.
Memory researchers Todd Sachter, Roger Nickel and Richard Hugenier.
Now it's time for the best science outside nature. It's the research highlights with Thea Cunningham.
Female fish find randy males more attractive, no matter whether the males are mating with females or other males. That's according to a team at the University of Frankfurt in Germany. They played a group of female Atlantic mollies, a video animation of males, and measured how long they spent close to the images, a measure of how interesting they were. The females preferred colourful males at first, but became increasingly attracted to drabber males that they saw mating with either sex. This may explain why bisexuality prevails in some species that live in groups. Find that report in Biology Letters. A woman paralysed in both arms and both legs has used brain power to move a prosthetic arm almost as precisely as a normal arm. Researchers at the University of Pittsburgh in Pennsylvania implanted two microelectrodes into the woman's motor cortex, the part of the brain responsible for movement. The electrodes recorded signals and sent them to the prosthetic arm via an external decoder. Less than 2 weeks after the system was fitted, the woman began training. Within 2 days of that, she could grasp and move objects almost as fast, smoothly and accurately as an able-bodied person. You can find that paper in The Lancet.
Before long, Richard Van Norden will be joining us with his science predictions for 2013. First, though, predicting the weather. When Hurricane Sandy hit the northeast coast of the United States late last October, it wasn't a surprise. Weather forecasts had picked up the hurricane and its whereabouts 10 days before it landed. The hurricane still devastated parts of the coast, and over 100 lives were lost. But without the long-range forecast, it could have been worse. Making these predictions requires skill and money. Both are in short supply in developing countries where tropical cyclones, floods and droughts arrive with very little notice and kill thousands each year. In a comment piece in Nature last week, Peter Webster from the Georgia Institute of Technology in Atlanta called for forecasters in the developed world to reach out to organisations elsewhere. Forging links could save billions of pounds and millions of lives, he told Natasha Gilbert.
So what's wrong with weather forecasting in the developing world?
Two things. Number one, to build the type of system, the global weather systems that the United Kingdom has, and that the European Union has, takes many, 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 many years. It takes, number one, enormous skill and an scientific infrastructure and support from governments. For a developing nation to do that, it just would require so much intellectual capital, would require so much money, it's just not a feasible event. Rather, the developing countries can be using or should be using the forecasts that are produced by these major centres.
What impact has the lack of proper weather forecasting in the developing world had on, you know, the extent of the damage caused by extreme weather events?
The impact of a lack of warning, if you would like, of extreme events has been catastrophic. You take a farmer in Bangladesh, he and his family will probably encounter in their generation four or five major floods. And in that time, that they will get at the best 1 or 2 days notice, which means they can't do anything about it. And so there's an acceptance, sort of a born to suffer aspect, because there's no warning.
So what kind of systems or partnerships do we need to put in place so that we can better predict the weather in developing world countries?
One of the great problems of the global weather forecasts is that they pump out an enormous amount of data. And we're talking about, for a 10-day forecast, terabytes of data. So the first thing is that, let's assume we take a nation, Myanmar, they decide that they want to utilize the output from the European Centre or the UK Met Office. Even if you can get the right amount of data, you have to process that data into a forecast which is means something for the region. And so the two things that you can do is, one, you could have either the place like the UK Met Office can issue forecasts for every region in the world. And that's just an impossible thing to do. They have the data, but they don't have the personnel to be able to have a Myanmar desk or a Mongolia desk or something like that. But what you can do are form relationships between the global centres, forecasting centres, and the Myanmars and the Mongolias, where you have groups of people who are used to developing modules for flood forecasting. Things that take that data in one end, enormous amount of data, and out would come a regional forecast at the other.
And is there any efforts underway to do that?
Yes, we provided Bangladesh with a 10-day forecasting system, which became operational in 2007, I think it was. And that works very, very well. But after a while, as in many situations, it's very, very difficult to continue them, because the money to do this type of thing normally comes from something like USAID or Oxfam or whatever it might be. And they have many, many problems around the world. So normally you get limited funding for 3 years. You develop the system, hand over the technology, and often the grapes dry on the vine, simply because those nations you give it to have their own problems too, and limited finance. So in the end, you finish up with a system that is not transferred for the long term.
And presumably it's going to become ever more urgent to do these sorts of forecasts as the climate changes and extreme weather events become more frequent.
You know, that's a very good point. Issues like fresh water availability and floods now become more important because more people are going to be affected, even if there's no climate change. The second thing is that there is some indication that floods will become more frequent and tropical cyclones may be more intense. And if that's the case, again, more people being impacted by stronger, longer extreme events is something to worry about.
Natasha Gilbert speaking to Peter Webster. Remember, Peter's comment piece is still available to read at nature.com/nature.
Next up, reporter Ewan Calloway finds out how stimulating the brain could help patients with a little-known condition called dyscalculia.
Yeah, ever since I was a kid, since I was 4 or 5, I was good at other subjects but terrible at maths. That's Paul Moorcraft, a veteran war correspondent and author who lives near London.
I couldn't do my times table. I still can't. I used to count with my fingers, which is very embarrassing when you're an adult and you're at a board meeting in the City of London. But I developed that when I was a kid. I counted with my fingers. So if I had sums more than 10, you know, I had a problem. Somebody asked me a mental arithmetic question, I'd freeze.
Moorcraft has a severe case of dyscalculia. It's like dyslexia, but for math. As much as 7% of the population has the condition. With more, here's Patricia Babdi, a London-based teacher who specializes in dyscalculia.
For most of us, if you see a few objects, say up to 3 or 4, you can tell how many there are without having to count them. This is called subitizing. The dyscalculic is unable to do this, so if you put, say, 2 pencils on the table and say how many are there, they will have to count them individually. They lack number sense, this inbuilt ability that people who are not dyscalculic have. And so you have to start right at the beginning and develop it. Quite what is happening in the brain, I don't know. That changes it, but clearly something is happening.
But what? Neuroscientists are beginning to identify brain regions important for number sense and which may also malfunction in dyscalculics. In the parietal lobe, the area that sits above and behind the ear, there are neurons that respond to different quantities. Activity patterns in the parietal lobe and other areas can be altered in dyscalculic kids when they play games that hone their number sense, like navigating a number line. It takes weeks of training to see an effect. One neuroscientist wants to give the brain a helping hand. Roy Cohen-Gadosh at the University of Oxford has found that delivering small jolts of electricity to the brain helps people learn math. At the moment, he is testing whether stimulation delivered to a brain area important for learning, the prefrontal cortex, can help dyscalculics.
So basically what we use is a method that deliver very low current, a non-painful electrical current that is coming from 2 AA batteries. So it's not something that gives to someone any pain or electric shock. It's very mild tingling sensation on the scalp. And what the low current actually doing is penetrating through the scalp and is able to change the excitability of the neurons, of the areas that are involved in maths, in order to make them more responding into the mathematical material that the person is trained on.
His method is called transcranial direct current stimulation, or TDCS, and he invited me to his Oxford lab to give it a try. In a darkened psychology classroom, Cohen-Kadosh fiddles with a desktop computer that controls the electrical stimulation and then fits a cap that looks a bit like a rugby helmet.
It's ready.
Okay.
Whenever you're ready.
Is it stimulating now?
No, I will. You want me to ready when I start?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah?
I brace myself for a shock, but it feels more like a baby tugging gently on my hair.
I started.
Have you?
Yep.
Can't feel it.
Can you hear
me? Yeah, I feel like a little. Yeah. Ooh, yeah. Yeah, I feel that. Okay. I'm learning now.
While my prefrontal cortex is zapped, I play a video game that involves placing fractions on a number line between 0 and 1. It's no problem for simple fractions like 3/5, but a value like 11/18 requires a lot of mental arithmetic.
This requires quite a few
calculations. Yeah, you need to calculate. That's absolutely true.
I mean, because I don't know if I'm doing it right. At first I was looking for visual cues. I was like, okay, that box hits right at about 75%, 0.75, but I can't remember them, so I'm sitting here trying to go, like, okay, that's...
Okay, so 10 minutes of practice isn't going to help me work out the tip on a restaurant bill any faster, but Cohen-Kadosh has found that with enough training, TDCS helps adults with dyscalculia improve their numerical abilities.
So we have several studies by now on basic numerical skills, but also on arithmetics, showing that we can actually improve learning of this functions, basically, when it is coupled with brain stimulation to the region that is involved with the acquisition of this cognitive function. It needs to be targeted during training. Just stimulation alone will not help. And when we do that, actually, we find that there is actually a beneficial effect that is also lasting up to 6 months after training.
Well, hopefully I'll be smarter for that.
I don't think it's going to make such a magic thing so fast.
Cohen Kadosh plans to start testing it with dyscalculic children later this year, and other researchers are testing the same technique for boosting recovery after stroke and treating depression. But don't stock up on batteries just yet. Until Cohen Kadosh's method is tested further, it's likely that plain old practice will be the best way for children with dyscalculia to learn their 1-2-3s. Paul Moorcraft thinks he is too old to benefit much from training, even though he's been a frequent guinea pig for neuroscientists studying the condition. But he has a message for dyscalculic children and their parents.
A lot of dyscalculic people can achieve a great deal. You know, they became a professor, or many books. And it's a question of recognizing the problem, overcoming it, and not being swamped into thinking I'm useless. I'm thick. I can't do things.
That was Paul Moorcraft. And before him, Patricia Babtie and Roy Cohen Kadosh. I'm Ewan Calloway.
News now, and welcome to Richard Van Norden. Hi, Richard.
Hello, Kerry.
Happy New Year. Now, we're about to talk about some of your predictions for science in 2013, but we're going to start, first of all, with some very recent news. On Monday of this week, an effort to stop the government in the US funding stem cell research came to an end.
Yes, this is a case that's been going on for more than 3 years. Two researchers have sued the National Institutes of Health in America, trying to stop them funding research that involves stem cells derived from human embryos.
Now, we've covered the work of these researchers in the past and their campaign to get embryonic stem cell research struck off the sort of funding register. Tell us a little bit more about the background to this.
Well, this was in August 2009 that James Shirley, who's at the Boston Biomedical Research Institute, and Teresa Deischer, who's CEO at a company called AVM Biotechnology, sued the NIH, and they essentially feel that using human embryos for research is, well, what Shirley now calls research slavery. They put it in very strong terms. At the time, it came several months after President Obama liberalized the stem cell policy of George Bush and would allow lots of new human embryonic stem cell lines to be available to researchers and to be funded by the US government. Now, the case came before a judge in 2010, and he, if you remember, he actually shut down all NIH-funded experiments for 17 days, which really shocked researchers and was the first sign that this was serious. But then a higher appeals court stayed the injunction, and then it took a lot of years for this lawsuit to move through the courts.
Now, the recent news is on Monday that the Supreme Court has just refused to hear this case.
That's right. Last year, the US Court of Appeals said that NIH was allowed to fund research on human embryonic stem cells, and the plaintiffs appealed to the Supreme Court, and they have turned it down. They're not going to hear the case, and they're not going to explain why. It's a typical practice for the Supreme Court. So that is that. There's no more appeal. And so if you're funded by the NIH, you can now work on stem cells derived from human embryos.
People had presumably continued to work on human embryonic stem cells during the time that the case was going through the courts.
Yeah, they had a kind of nagging worry that funding might be cut off at any time. And that was really the problem. And the threat of this lawsuit did kind of stop some researchers from entering the field because of this uncertainty. And Deischer says, you know, we've kind of accomplished one of our goals because we've got scientists to work on the other type of stem cells that derived from adults. So they feel that to some extent it was worth it. But a lot of researchers have carried on working on embryonic stem cells, and they're all absolutely delighted that now the NIH can continue to fund them for certain.
Yeah, nice New Year's present for them. Elsewhere in 2013 then, what can we expect to see in the world of biology more generally?
Well, talking again of human embryonic stem cells, we should expect to see the first research results from a clinical trial. This is from Advanced Cell Technology, a private company in California, and they've been injecting retinal cells derived from embryonic stem cells into the eyes of about 36 people with various forms of non-treatable degenerative blindness. It's just a safety test, but it's the only company currently testing these under an FDA-approved trial. So that should come through in the summer.
Elsewhere, I see on your list here, you've got gene patents going through the courts again.
Yeah, the US Supreme Court has decided to look at some of interesting cases with scientific implications. And one of them is, are genes patentable? And this is another long lawsuit related to patents held by Myriad Genetics on genes for breast cancer. Is it possible to patent genes? Does that stop research in the field? Those are the kinds of questions they'll be considering.
All right, moving from biology then to Earth and climate science, the fifth report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change.
That'll be the really big news. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change hasn't updated its report since 2007, and part of its new fifth assessment is due to appear in September, just the conclusions of one of the working groups on the basic science of global warming, but we should see some updates on what the consensus is on the science, things like the risk of extreme weather events, flooding. We'll see new estimates for that and for the extent of warming that we should expect.
And I see elsewhere on your list we are probing the oceans in a very expensive project.
This is a giant underwater surveillance network called the US Ocean Observatories Initiative. It's almost $400 million, and it won't be completed till 2015. It's going to monitor everything from earthquakes undersea, ocean circulation, ocean chemistry, shifting ecosystems, all the way from where the sea meets the air down to the seabed in about seven sites around the world. This year, we're going to get the first results in from some sites, particularly around the US.
Okay, and moving on to physics, of course, 2012 is probably a difficult year to beat with all that Higgs excitement going on. But what does 2013 have in store?
Well, 2013, I think the really big stories are going to be planetary in physics. We're going to have the Planck Space Telescope. That'll give us a really comprehensive map of the faint microwave afterglow from the Big Bang, which could provide evidence for gravitational waves that may have been generated when the universe had a period of sudden cosmic inflation. We're going to see a number of spacecraft launched to orbit the Moon from China and from NASA. NASA are also going to launch a mission to explore Mars, as is India. And, of course, we've still got the Curiosity rover on Mars sending back results from the red planet's surface.
All right, so it looks like the Moon and Mars are both going to be quite busy places to be this year. And in material science, this is something you've written about in the past, graphene. Any updates there?
Well, graphene is still going to be the celebrity of material science, but what we should see is a number of reports about copycat materials, so two-dimensional layered materials and sheets that you can stack, have interesting electronic behaviour, things like boron nitride and tantalum disulfide and other rather exotic elements that are really launching off the sorts of experiments that have been done with graphene.
So lots to look forward to in 2013 then. Thank you, Richard, for coming in, and more on all those stories and a lot more at nature.com/news. That's it for this week. Thanks to freesfx.co.uk for the sound effects used in this programme. Join us next time when we'll hear why some archaeologists are rebuilding the past and trace the branches of a distinguished scientific dynasty. I'm Kerry Smith.
And I'm Charlotte Stoddart.